This is Sylvester McCoy. You're listening to Who Made Who, and Me Made Me, and my mother and father did the same.
You're listening to a podcast from the Cinema Geekly Podcast Network. We're the geeks you deserve and the ones you need right now.
Welcome to Who Made Who, Cinema Geekly's Doctor Who podcast. It is Anthony Lewis and Ben Knight, and we are back to finally talk some more Doctor Who, the Christmas special. Our second in a row.
Sorry, I'll stop that. I was just overexcited. So sorry.
we are back in the... Oh, hello? Can we get copyright...
Not for that pair. Okay. No, not for that. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. Anyway, two Christmases in a row, thanks to Russell T. Davis, has brought the Doctor Who Christmas special back. And this year's is called Joy to the World. It might sound like a song title, and I didn't even really think about it all that much until the very end of this episode, but... Then, obviously, kind of on the nose with so many things. I was distracted by a really good middle section of this episode. Anyway, let us begin with a doctor arriving at a time hotel, an establishment that allows visits to historical points. The doctor enlists the aid of Trev as he investigates a mysterious briefcase. Trev's manager, a Silurian, arrives in Joy Elmondo's hotel room. And I would like to, did she at any point say what her last name was? Because it says it here on the internet, but I only ever recalled her throughout the episode saying her first name, but whatever.
Does she say it when she checks in?
Maybe she does?
Yeah.
I wasn't paying that
close attention. Well, I'm just thinking, because logically you would, wouldn't you?
I suppose that makes sense, yeah.
Oh, no, actually, no, she doesn't. She says, hi, I need a room just for the week.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And then the receptionist says, single, and she says, isn't that obvious?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so no, I don't think she does.
Well, he arrived, the Silurian...
Dear so-called Stephen Moffat, why, oh, why?
That's Moffat's writing this, that's why.
Yes.
We've got our first Moffat of the evening. Will there be a second? Who knows? Merchandise available at geeklymerch.com. The Silurian enters Joy's hotel room with the briefcase, and the doctor is following him. The briefcase takes control of Joy via handcuff. The doctor finds a strange device inside about to disintegrate Joy when the doctor from the future arrives from the time hotel with a required code to shut it off. The future doctor returns to the time hotel with Joy. I love how they're just skipping over the best part of this show. The doctor returns to the time hotel with Joy, stranding the current doctor. Oh, no, they do mention it a little bit here. It's like a sentence. Mm-hmm. He takes a job working at the hotel, befriending the manager, Anita, awaiting for an opportunity to get back to the time hotel, which he does a year later. Forget all that good stuff in the middle, and then he opens a door to the distant past where he frees Joy by provoking her anger. The briefcase is of Villengard origin, which, by the way...
Villengard.
Villengard. Not a great company name if you don't want to sound like the bad guys.
Why has it changed its pronunciation since we've... Because we've encountered
Villengard. Right?
Yeah, and now it's Villengard. And I'm wondering if it's... gradually morphing towards another word that sounds a bit like it, and that's why they've deliberately changed pronunciation.
Stalingrad.
I wonder if it might end up as Valiard.
Oh, it may. Over time, names and
just because it's obviously mandatory to reference in every episode, yes, whether we think Susan's going to be back and whether we think that the Valiard's going to be back. So there we go. Box ticked. If you had that on your bingo card for this episode, done.
So the briefcase of Villengard origin is used to create an energy source. Trev, who connected physically to the Villengard system before he died, reveals the briefcase location. The Doctor is able to open it, but Joy lets the star seed, which is a phrase we've not mentioned before this point in this paragraph, but is just mentioned here, enter her. This is a very poorly written short description of this episode. Joy pilots it into space, where it detonates safely and becomes the Star of Bethlehem. And the star gives hope and comfort to all who see it. Joy to the world. Merry Christmas. God bless us all. And
everyone.
And humbug. And all the other Christmas sayings. Every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings. I'm sure everybody here has seen It's a Wonderful Life. Anyway, Ben, what did you think? What did you think of this year's Christmas special?
Overall, I really liked it. It's always nice to have some Who at Christmas. It would be weird if we didn't. I treated myself to not watching it on Christmas Day because, you know, annoying children and what have you. And so instead I watched it on the big screen, but in a VR helmet. So I watched
it. So kind of?
Yeah, which, I really recommend it as a viewing experience. I'm not actually a big fan of sort of Quest 3 gaming and stuff, but actually for watching movies or sort of cinematic television, like the technology is finally there now for it to be a comfortable experience.
But okay.
Anyway, so there are smashes and trashes from this whole thing. Obviously goes without saying, Nicola Coughlan, probably one of the finest new talents in television. I mean, I say new, you know, Derry Girls is not a new show. It's been around for a long time, but, and obviously Bridgerton, including that scene this year, she's certainly having a good time of things, in terms of career. I particularly enjoyed having Joel Fry in this. The only thing I'll say about both of those, I mean, Joel is now, I would say, at a sort of level of notoriety that it's a shame to see him kind of be wasted in such a small part as this. The same's true of Nicola, but I can't see much scope for her being a sort of massively returning character. So if it's a one and done for her, then, you know, might as well go out with a bang, which I suppose she did. The episode itself does suffer from Moffat situations in the sense that, you know, when you hear about a star will rise in a Christmas episode, like, right, so something ends up as the star above Bethlehem at some point. And of course it does. There are lots of bits that don't make sense. It's a classic Moffat thing of don't look too hard at the actual plot of this episode. There is a bit of a discussion as to whether it's a Raiders of the Lost Ark situation, I don't think it is, because the suitcase wouldn't have attached itself to Joy but for the Doctor's intervention, because she wouldn't have met the criteria, I guess, for it. But then it also doesn't explain how she ended up really sort of reassigning its roles. One thing we know about Villengard or Villengard is that their weapons are, you know, they are relentless. And so the idea that Joy and Trev somehow managed to repurpose or redirect that weapon doesn't really fit with what we know about the way that those weapons work, or indeed the trope of science fiction when it comes to weapons that have some sort of consciousness. Literally just about every sci-fi franchise for an example of one of those episodes, from, you know, Red Dwarf, Star Trek, and everything else. But I mean, production wise, what I'm really enjoying, I'll be honest, is the fact that one of the big fears that a lot of people had about the Disney era of Who was that it would become unrecognizable with, you know, Disney production choices, Disney money. And this wasn't. There was still quite a lot of practical effects in there. I know that particularly because I watched the, I don't think it's called Doctor Who Confidential anymore, is it? What's it called? Unleashed, I think, isn't it?
Something like that,
Yeah, so I watched that, and you know, I was pleased to see that there's quite a lot of practical effect work in there, and I thought there was looking at it. And it has the feel of specifically RTD era Who, and I think that's great, because I think Disney could have absolutely fucked this by you know, making too many of their House of Mouse decisions, and I think that's always been a risk. The use of the bootstrap paradox, I think, was quite good fun and one for the nerds out there. And, you know, so I didn't have any problems with that. Quite a lot of the internet, I think, seemed to have missed the reference to the bootstrap paradox, or didn't bother looking at what that was or something. I don't know. And so they got angry about that. Nice to see the Silurians back. And also that gentle reminder that they were the original inhabitants of Earth. I thought that was, I think it's, like, it's been a while since that point's been made to us. And I wonder if that's something we might see some sort of revisit on at some point. The plot itself, like I say, I'm not gonna, there's so much in it you could absolutely rag on, but is it a fun, slightly silly romp that mixes, you know, comedy and action and a little bit of light and shade and all the stuff you want out of a Christmas episode? Absolutely. Could you have removed the snow in it and made it just a regular episode of Doctor Who? Pretty much. But that's fine. That's, as I think Stephen Moffat said, yeah, that's all Christmas specials of Doctor Who. Was it a weird choice to have Moffat write it a little bit? Although Moffat himself said, well, he was asked to write it by Russell, because in Russell's words, it meant that he wouldn't have to write a Christmas special, as opposed to concentrating on, you know, the sort of main arcs and the big work of the main show. But it, you know, it, they are a great pairing. And, you know, when you see that three, particularly those three names, Russell, Stephen, and Julie Gardner as well, of course, when you see those three names at the, you know, at the top of the credits for particularly a standalone Who episode, you know exactly what you're going to get. And this is exactly what you get. So, yeah, I enjoyed all of that. There were quite a lot of Easter eggs in there. I mean, we sometimes forget, I think, that, again, that's something, that particular pairing of Moffat and Davis, they done off love themselves some Easter eggs. And so, you know, and it tends to be references to stuff outside of Who. So, you know, I think Den of Geek did a quite a nice summary. If I can read my shorthand, it says something along the lines of Orient Express. Oh, yeah. So you see the passenger on the Orient Express is Sylvia Trench, according to the credits. And so that would be the first Bond movie, Bond girl, who is, you know, I don't think that's the same character, obviously, but there's obviously a reference there. You see the Lord of the Rings reference again. It's not the first time we've had that in Who either, but here
the Hobbit door,
the Hobbit door, yeah, absolutely. You get the time traveler's wife reference to De Tambell's, the restaurant in the hotel. You get the what was the other one? I can't understand what I've written here. Oh yeah, my favorite one. So Mr. Bent, now this is one for the UK viewers, really. I assume, I don't think the show was anywhere else. There was a kids cartoon in the 80s, well 70s actually, through to the 80s, called Mr. Bent, spelt with two N's, as it was in this episode. And the whole deal with Mr. Bent, and I grew up watching this, and also what with my name being Ben, the number of people who would frequently reference it in relation to me was never ceased being original and funny. But the whole deal with Mr. Bent was he would step into the local fancy dress shop. We don't know why. I don't think that was ever really explored. And he would go into the changing room and would put on a costume and would be transported into a world where he was the thing that he dressed up as. So like space suit, he'd become a spaceman or suit of armor and what have you. So, yeah, so that was a nice little nod, I suppose. I don't know if you went through the various leaflets in the reception of the hotel, but it was basically a sort of list of the various historical Doctor Who episode. So, you know, you had the OK Corral in there and the fires of Pompeii, all that sort of stuff in there, which was fun. There's reference to a lot of previous episodes, particularly Moffat and Davis era episodes. They seem to be ignoring Chibnall for some reason. So there's loads of stuff like that. Obviously, Villengard, take your pick, is referenced in there. That's obviously something that's going to play a sort of major part going forward, because we're not done with them. I figure they're a sort of new arching, kind of recurring, somewhat mysterious bad guy type organization. So fair enough. So yeah, it was, there was a lot going on. A lot of it didn't make sense, but it was held together really very well by what is a great but quite small cast, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Was there as much of the emotion in this episode that we tend to associate with the Christmas specials? I thought not. And this is what I know. I'm just going to say it because I know everyone's going on about it with every episode. The Doctor cries 4 times in this episode. And on the first occasion, somebody he's literally just met seconds earlier, then as far as he knows, dies, although I don't suppose he necessarily knows that he's dying rather than being, I don't know, transported or something else.
Mm-hmm.
And he cries at that. The only tears that seem to make sense to me in this episode for him are when, what's her name? I've forgotten character's name. Anita, the...
Yes.
Yeah, from the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So he's spent a year with her, which he has actually done in the past, of course, but because he has taken the long way around several times.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, yeah, so when they separate, I kind of get that, maybe. And I think the problem with this, I don't mind the Doctor being emotional at all. I don't mind the Doctor crying. I think that's fine too. But we are bordering on the Doctor being emotionally dysregulated at this point. And I don't think, from everything I've seen from what Russell said, although, you know, he speaks with forked tongue quite often, I don't think it is a choice to make him emotionally dysregulated, like he's having a sort of, you know, sort of slow speed breakdown of some description. But that is increasingly how it's looking. And I don't get it. I don't think it's necessary. And I think it's in danger of eclipsing, you know, Shiji Gatwa is a good actor and has been playing this role really well. Mm-hmm. This episode was filmed back in October of 2023, so before the first of his Christmas specials was even broadcast. So it's a long time ago. And, you know, we've seen him grow into the role. I just don't think it's necessary, and I don't get it. But I think that's probably the only big down for me. The biggest up, and it's the one that's had an awful lot of the media attention in the UK, rather predictably, is that when Joy goes on her rant, quite rightly, about her mum dying in hospital with COVID, whilst those awful people were partying and drinking. So it's a direct attack on Boris Johnson and that Tory administration,
mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, well, I mean, yeah, some of the right-wing press are a little bit salty about that being called out. Well, no, it deserves to be called out, and the population should perpetually call it out. And so, and the other thing is, given that when it's set and the Doctor is trying to extract this most powerful of visceral responses from Joy's character for a legitimate plot purpose, that's like the most obvious thing that they could have used. So I don't think it was shoehorned in there, which is what I think the Telegraph and the Express have been bitching about. I completely legit, and it was probably the strongest bit of sort of heavyweight acting by both Shuti and Nicola. So I was here for that, to be honest with you. The only scene I really hated, because it made no sense, it in fact it detracted from the weight of some of the episode, was when Joy's mum was in hospital towards the end. So after Joy's become the star, or has been, I guess, sucked up into the star or whatever, and you know, she then dies in the hospital, and you see her being converted into Stardust and going up and joining her daughter. It makes no sense. There is no logical explanation for
no
that
idea
happening.
Why that happened. Yeah,
Christmas episode of let her go and be with them makes no sense. Wasn't necessary. Detracted from the gravity of quite a lot of it. But you know, we're not left with any Moffat mysteries. Perhaps other than that, as I say, it's one of those things. Don't look too carefully because you will find. I can think of at least three parts of the plot that aren't actually resolved. They're just sort of left flapping in the wind, but that's fine. Yeah. It is what it is. So yeah, a solid episode for what it is.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how I feel about it. I liked it. I guess overall I liked it, but I think I kind of gave away the ghost a little bit earlier by mentioning what I thought was what was the best part of this episode. And it was the early chunk of the episode where he spent most of his time with Anita Benn. And that just worked for me on a bunch of levels. Partially it's because of, like, I'm projecting my own life and my own situation into like moments of shows that I watch. But, like, we see so much of the Doctor's wibbly-wobbly stuff and just the shenanigans and the craziness. And they spend too little time, I think, on the character. And I sort of get it to a degree because this character is going to be played by other people. It's going to keep being played by other people, and other people are going to bring things to it. But I feel like they're always sort of core elements of the Doctor's personality and, like, who they are at their, at their core. And it's brought up far too few in episodes. And often when it is brought up, it's like they do something great with it, but then it's just sort of forgotten about or an afterthought, because we can't get too heavy. We can never get too heavy with the character, I guess. So for me, like,
I think that's only because when you look back, certainly in modern Who years, the episodes where you get character development of the Doctor, proper, you know, sort of long-term story arc character development, are the ones that are written by the showrunner at the time.
Yeah.
And so as soon as it's subcontracted to someone else, and Russell and Stephen were particularly kind of jealous guardians of big plot stuff or big arc stuff. Even when each other were writing episodes during each other's run, that was something you'd see. There would never be any proper Doctor development in those episodes. And I do wonder if that's a sort of side effect of this sort of subcontracted writing that that they have between them.
So, like, for me, it all began when they did the bootstrap thing where the Doctor shows up to give himself the code. And the only reason he knows the code a year later is because his future self gave him the code. It's never explained, you know, because that's the bootstrap paradox. It's never explained how he comes up with the code or how he gets the code. It's just one of those things. But
it's like that.
His frustration, I mean, me too, because it's one of those things that sort of breaks your brain a little bit. But, like, that's the moment where he also kind of snaps at himself, where he's like, this is why nobody likes you. This is why, you know, people don't want to hang around you for too long. And he has that one moment of, like, he's like, you know, you live in this giant ship, but there's no chairs because, like, nobody ever comes by to visit to sit down. And then, like, a minute after future him leaves, he's like, oh my God, like, I don't have any, like, there's nowhere to sit in there, which is kind of like a funny throwaway line, but it's used for something great later. And it's just like the Doctor is always running from stuff or running from something or running to something. And whenever he gets these things, it was sort of like the episodes during Moffat's run where he, I can't remember, was it like when he was with Amy and Rory and he like lived and you like lived with them for like a year or something? Mm-hmm. I don't remember what it is. But episodes like that are always really interesting to me. And the relationship he sort of, and I think, you know what, actually, you know what it is that I think makes me the most upset about this is that I felt for the hotel manager character. Like I felt bad. It felt very clear to me that she was like a kind of a lonely person who also didn't have a lot of friends, and like they both made
and he does run out on her. Yeah,
he does, but it does, it hurts him because he does, like, he obviously not only did he spend a year with her, but it's sort of intimated that he spent most of that year, like almost probably every day with this person. And they develop, like, it's impossible if you do that with somebody, it's impossible to not develop some sort of relationship with another person if you spend so much time with them. And I loved all of that. Like, it's, you know, and it's one of the things he says to her is like, I'm not used to living my life like this, like one day after the next and in order. You know, it's crazy, but it was amazing because you were amazing. And she has like the most heartbreaking line where she's like, please think about me every once in a while, which is,
well, he did though. He hooked her up.
He did. That is true. He didn't completely forget about her.
Yeah.
I mean, now
I liked
he will.
That actually. I liked the, well, I suppose.
Like, but going forward, I doubt we'll ever see that character again, but maybe.
I guess not, but we now have a really useful device in the Hooniverse, don't we, as well, that pertains to basically their time windows, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And that's handy because, you know, there are moments when, you know, when the TARDIS isn't available, and that's another sort of useful tool.
Yeah.
One thing I didn't get from the episode, though, which I only picked up from, I can't remember if I read it or if it was on Unleashed, but the idea behind those, you know, the truth about the fact that hotel rooms very often have a door that is locked in them, unusually, but so do Airbnbs as well. Mm-hmm. The idea is that the Time Hotel was set up by an association of all of the hotel companies and chains in the world in whatever year. And it's a capitalist enterprise. The idea was that they looked back over all of those hotel rooms that they didn't book out over the whole of time and tried to figure out a way of monetizing them by going back in time to sell them in the future.
Yeah.
Which I kind of wish that I'd been somewhere in the episode, because what a bloody brilliant idea as a justification for it. I thought it was excellent.
Mm-hmm. Also, this is, I don't know how many times a T-Rex has appeared in original Doctor Who, but since the reboot, this is the second time we've seen a T-Rex. This one looked better than the first one.
Oh, God, definitely. Yeah.
Not that the first one we saw was awful, but this one was significantly better. Also, this is the first episode where I really noticed the Dr. Sonic screwdriver, which really looks more like a Sonic Kinder Egg than a screwdriver. But whatever.
Yeah, they're strange weird, design this time around.
Weird shape, like a mouse or something for
merchandising, merchandising, boys and girls. Yeah.
I mean, hey, with that shape, you probably could make a computer mouse.
I mean, I haven't looked on the internet, but you know, there already is.
There's something on Etsy, I'm sure. Yeah, if we brought back the Etsy game, I'm sure we'd find it. I mean, I know I'm completely glossing over all the rest of the other stuff in this episode. Like that,
a lot happens, doesn't it?
I mean, the moment with Anita, like that bit of the episode was like that's the time that I enjoyed the most, because it felt it felt like I was learning something about the character, and it still felt Christmassy to me, and it still had some of like some of those elements to it. When we went back and caught up with future him, with Joy, and going through all of that, it was fine, but I was not as interested in all of that stuff. And the ending felt, I hate to use this word, but a little cringy. I kind of grit my teeth a little bit at the end. When it's like,
well, I think it was so obvious that that was coming, and I don't know. My brain almost cancelled it out because I was like, yeah, well, obviously, whatever.
Yeah,
I didn't care for it particularly, but yeah, it was, you know, if you're gonna do a thing at Christmas that involves something creating a star, I guess there is only one thing you can do with that, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, at least we can look up and see Joy in the night sky. That star is...
And inexplicably her mum.
Yep, she's up there too. But and yay, Trev.
And yay, Trev. Here's to Trev.
He was doing his best job. He was really working hard.
He was.
Well... He was. Ben, if you have any final thoughts on Joy to the World, what would you have to say, and what would you give the episode?
I have no final thoughts. I do find some of the internet theories about it and things going forward vaguely interesting, but I think we can probably say this is more or less a bottle episode, really. And despite all of its problems that we've alluded to, I think there's enough of substance in it and enough kind of it feels like a good episode. It may not in any real technical sense be a particularly standout episode, but it feels like a good episode, and it gets 3.75 from me, which I can't decide if that's too harsh, but I think it's about right. It's been moderated for upon reflection.
Excellent. I landed like a 3.5. It had the makings. This is just one of those situations. This feels like something I was going through when Aurora and I were reviewing The Walking Dead : Daryl Dixon : The Book of Carol season 2. that I had a better TV show in my mind than the one that the writers were.
I enjoyed that show, but yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. I like the first season of it. The second season, we didn't enjoy as much.
The first season was better.
But this is the same situation. Like, I found myself in an episode where I'm like, I'm loving this, but little did I know that Stephen Moffat is like, no, that's not the part. You're not supposed to, like, that's supposed to just be like, oh, that's nice. Now back to the real story. It's like, you fell in love with the B plot or whatever. And I'm like, aw.
Often the way with Moffat episodes.
Yeah.
We've, you know, if you go back and consider them, there's been a whole bunch of times where we found the B plot more interesting than the A plot.
Yeah. It's just, yeah. One of those things, everybody.
Mm.
Oh, well. Well,
I did think it was a little strange, by the way, that we didn't see Anita Dobson in any part of this episode.
No, she was absent.
Yeah, and obviously we have a brief flash of Ruby.
Just the briefest,
which, you know, I guess that was okay for us to have a bit of Ruby in there. I think it was just a gentle reminder that Ruby still exists.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I would have liked to have seen Anita Dobson, I think, maybe. Only because I just love Anita Dobson. And secondly, because the little nudges we get from her, whether it's quite often it's the costume rather than what she says, isn't it?
Yeah.
I sort of felt I vaguely missed that, which is a good sign because it means I'm now obviously invested in what's coming. Do we have a little bit of a spoilers warning here before talking about the trailer briefly, do you think?
Oh, if you want to. I've not even seen the trailer, so go ahead and talk about it. Like, I don't care about spoilers, but spoilers for anybody who might care.
I mean, so much as they are, I mean, you know, I don't know. There's very little given away, I would say, in this trailer. And I think that's, you know, that's on purpose, clearly. The bit where we see Mrs. Flood sat in a cinema, I think is interesting because so far she's existed in, if you will, the current time. That is to say 2024. And that cinema looks old. She's dressed, well, she's around people dressed in a slightly old-fashioned manner. The thing that she's watching is a sort of 1930s, maybe a bit later, cartoon. And so it would appear she might be time-traveling now, which is interesting. But she's sat there with her little opera glasses in the cinema watching this cartoon character coming out of the screen in a sort of kids' version of The Ring sort of way. The suggestion, I suppose, from people is that in the same trailer, we do see, in fact, no, it's from Elite Productions still, I think, we do see what appears to be a board outside, I presume, a cinema that has the word Harbinger on it. So I think, you know, all of these theories that we're carrying on the gods theme are probably right. It would be weird if we weren't going to carry on with that. And I think it's almost inevitable that Mrs. Flood ultimately is going to be, you know, some sort of god of storytelling or something along those lines. And I'm really looking forward to that, actually.
Okay.
And I've got some faith in Russell being the right person to deliver that, because I think it could get way too messy. People say complicated with Moffat, and I don't always think the word complicated is right. I think sometimes the word is simply messy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Russell does tend to be a bit more straightforward with the storytelling. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. We see, obviously, the new companion briefly. We know that she's seemingly working in a hospital. I don't think we really gain a lot more. The only thing that I think a lot of people have noticed is there seems to be quite a lot more sci-fi stuff within that trailer. There's a lot of sort of spacesuits and futuristic underwater stuff. There's a planet that looks a bit like Scaro, but not quite like Scaro, with like proper kind of 1950s UFOs floating about in it, which is quite cool and oddly retro. The look of it all, again, you know, it's carrying on the proper, I guess, modern era Who aesthetic, and it's all got that kind of vibrant Russell T. Davis visual style, which is nice to see. Whether there are some obviously sort of missing bits from it, I would say there probably are. But I think they're trying not to give too much away, and they've certainly succeeded in that regard. Is it something that I'm looking at and thinking, you know, I'm looking forward to it? Absolutely. We do see what appeared briefly to look like a possible regeneration scene in it, but I'm not sure that's what it was. I think that might have been a misdirect.
Yeah, they've done that before as well.
Yeah, well, I think there are two bits in it. There's one where you see what appears to be the sort of light from, you know, that kind of very specific sort of golden yellow light from regeneration. Reflected on the face of somebody, I can't remember who it was now, whoever it was anyway. And there's another one where Shooty's doing that classic thing where the doctor looks down at his hand and is examining it sort of towards the camera, which, you know, has become a bit of a trope of regeneration scenes in modern Who, hasn't it? That he does that and then his hand suddenly, you know, and there it goes. So yeah, there's a lot going on there. And the only other thing to say about it is that Russell teased the other day that we may be getting this season of Who rather quicker than we expected.
Well, I guess that depends on your perspective.
It depends
Russell.
What you expected.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if he means that they've changed the release order of season two. Well, I hate calling
series
it that.
Series 15.
Yeah, quite. Or whether, yeah, so whether they switched that with the standalone miniseries thingy called whatever the hell it's called. London Sea thingy. So yeah, I don't know whether maybe that's what's going on. But yeah, it all looks pretty promising. And, you know, Disney don't seem to have broken it, which is, I think, something a lot of people worried about.
Yeah, yeah.
And it looks like more of what we'd hope for from Russell, I think.
Okay. Well, something to look forward to in the new year, eventually, whenever that may be, sooner than you think, apparently.
Well, in the meantime, there's a couple of really good, probably worth a mention, fan Well, fun films, actually.
Ooh, okay.
Kicking around out there. I'll try and find links for them, but just have a bit of a Google, listener. There's from Confused Adipose, who is, I think he's like a teenager who does a quite a nice Doctor Who YouTube channel. And he's been in one that's now been released. He released it on Christmas Day or Boxing Day, I think. And go and have a look at that. Also, you know, very, I shouldn't be plugging other people's channels, but a really nice little channel for Doctor Who. And the other one is Brandon McCaffrey, he of Secrets of a Wallaby Boy and various other things, and good friend of mine. Yes, I mingle with all of the famous people. But he, well, actually, the link being, I've mentioned it before, that film, because it also has Colin Baker in it, who, of course, was yes. Doctor Number Six. But yeah, so their show, which is a particularly sort of queer slant on Doctor Who, that was also released not that long ago and is really worth watching as well. So I guess look up, because I can't remember what it's called, which is quite embarrassing, but look up Brandon McCaffrey on IMDb, and then you can watch both Colin Baker in Secrets of a Wallaby Boy, well, hear him in that, I suppose, because he's playing an AI, and obviously the Doctor Who film as well. So yeah, if you're still trying to scratch the Doctor Who itch, there are some other things out there kicking around that are worth a watch.
Nice. And in the meantime, while you wait for whatever amount of time is sooner than you'd think, head on over to cinemageekly.com, where you can check out the archives of the show. Of course, this is a listener-supported podcast, and there are some ways you can help us out there if you'd like. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/cinemageekly. We also have the merch store. Ben, do you have the button handy for the merch store?
Listen,
no, he doesn't.
Okay. I do.
Oh, he does.
Geeklymerch.com.
I couldn't find the other button to.
That's make okay.
Things do the things.
That's
there's,
okay.
There's too much open on this desk.
Links for those are in the show notes for this episode. Yeah. Also, find us on Apple Podcasts.
Geeklymerch.com.
There it is. If you buy it, you would make a good Dalek.
Good Dalek.
See?
Yeah.
If you decide to do that. If not, it's okay. You just be a bad Dalek, and you know what happens to them. You can also find
Naughty
us on
Dalek.
You can also find us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, Pocket Casts, anywhere you can find a good podcast. Just search for Who Made Who. Hit subscribe, and that way you can join us the sooner than you think, according to Russell T. Davis, for episode 1 of Doctor Who Series 15 on BBC and Disney.